John Fain. On radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
My co-host today, before we bring in award-winning bestseller Nick Earls, who has rediscovered the joy of the novella. Why on earth the novella? How cute, how quaint. And Pamela Rabe, star of stage and screen. Pamela Rabe joins us soon, but the cruciverbalist David Astle is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today. Morning, David.
G'day, John.
Good to have you here.
Thanks very much.
Have you just been off to the Writers' Festival?
Yes, I'm a writer, I'll have you know.
A writer. The Sydney Writers' Festival.
Always gains an extra syllable this time of year.
Yeah. How was it rubbing shoulders with the great unwashed Sydney Writers' Festival glitterati?
It does have a wonderful surreal element to it, particularly in the breakfast bar where everyone's scrabbling around for their continental or their cooked breakfast. So, yes.
I didn't think writers got up for breakfast.
No, if it's free breakfast, you'll see every writer there just lining up. But we're not so polite. So, something like there was a ramekin of mushrooms there, and I remember diving in front of Russell Howcroft because I thought, really, on his budget, he doesn't really need mushrooms as much as I do. So I grabbed the last mushrooms.
Is he a writer?
He's a writer.
Russell Howcroft.
Well, this is a thing more and more with writers' festivals these days. They are kind of using the word writer as a bit of a stalking horse, getting in the likes of Russell and other thinkers and
he runs
media
a television
players.
Network. He appears mm-hmm. on a TV show. I think he has written a book. In fact, I think he was a guest on The Conversation Hour
there
when the
go.
Book came out.
How dare you denigrate the man? Mind you, he's hungry for mushrooms. That's it.
You know he runs a pie factory?
I did actually know that. And he's a demon's tragic. It did come up in the conversation.
He and his wife bought a pie factory, which she runs, apparently very successfully.
Well, you know that it would be well promoted. And that's what I was trying to say before the mushrooms and your challenge came in, was that writers' festivals are more and more being used as a festival of ideas. So not every person who's on their hind legs sharing their story or being part of a panel are necessarily scribes.
Oh, it appeals to the same fairly limited demographic, I might say, having been to a few writers' mm-hmm. festivals, being on the odd panel or moderating a discussion for other people, or when I had a book out, going to the writers' festival as a writer.
Yes, I saw you there.
And the demographic is, well, let me just say, it's not diverse.
This speaks to our next guest, Nick Earls, which we could talk about, the idea of the diminishing or elite cohort of readers. And also you need to have the cash money. Sydney is, I'm going to have to say, has a lot more sort of open door events than Melbourne does, and I think must have to do with the sponsorship deals.
Free to people to come in.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's
that always works.
Well, look, I'm not privy to the finances of either festival, but I know that is certainly metrically true, and it's much more. I do like that idea that you can stumble into a session without necessarily having to fork out, knowing full well what you're in for.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually applied in my case where I was sort of stuck for something to do for an hour, and there was a lecture called, funnily enough, The Power of Uncertainty. Now, it sounded like one of those self-help or life actualizing seminars, but it was a philosophical lecture.
I wouldn't even go to that if it was free.
Are you sure?
Yes. Very sure.
There was no...
I would have many other things to do, including rearranging the sock drawer instead.
No, don't be like that. In fact, it was a remarkable moment. The lecturer in question was a game developer who works for Google, and he was talking about the role of Santa Claus in children's lives. And kids, if you're listening to this, maybe just turn the volume down for a little bit.
Spoiler alert!
Because it is has
chocolate
been said,
doesn't grow on trees.
The ABC understands that Father Christmas is actually a fabrication. Yeah, hang on. What about the podcasts?
Oh,
I've blown that. It's been alleged. It's been alleged. Police have purported to say, and this whole idea about doubt and mythology is a really important part of philosophizing, discovery, scientific thinking about what we don't know is what we actually harp on. And in the middle of all this, the lecturer, his name is T.L. Ugalo, also stepped forward.
Ukulele?
No, don't look. You are being particularly puerile this morning, John. What have you had? Red cordial, have you, for morning tea?
I wish.
I'm trying to say something important.
And profound.
I am, because he came out as a transgender and was talking about how he's lived with doubt all his life. Right. And suddenly 350 people in a former wool warehouse at Walsh Bay in Sydney erupted in rapturous applause. And I thought, this is why we have writers' festivals, for remarkable moments like that.
How very inner Sydney.
Oh, listen to you. You're just switching between puerile and cynical. You're hard to follow.
I can do both at once.
Can you be puerile and cynical? I think you just managed it. Yeah, so anyway, and who's your hero? There you go. Question without notice.
Who's my hero?
Yeah.
What, full stop in the whole of the world?
Oh, well, come up. You can, you know, throw one up. It doesn't... I mean, you mentioned right. Tom Jones and Gloria Steinem. Are they, in your pantheon?
No. I'll do the Nelson Mandela shortcut there.
All right.
Well, is that all right?
It's a bit like having Shakespeare for your dinner party. Yeah. We've all got our staples.
I know it's safe.
One of my heroes
That'll do for the moment.
Yeah, but while I'm talking, you can start thinking.
Gets me out of
and
jail.
And put your cordial down. One of my heroes is... Well, in fact, I'll delay his name. I was... flipping through the guide, the Sydney Writers Festival guide, first day, I hadn't really done my due diligence, didn't know who was on, who was speaking. I knew I was there. That was the main thing, as far as I was concerned. But when I noticed that there was one speaker there who caught my eye, because I have been a long-time admirer of his work. I think I've almost read every word he's written. And then I looked to my side and there was a gentleman, a sort of late-aged English gentleman, I could tell because he had been fussing about his pot of tea. And I said, I wonder who that bloke is. And suddenly the two coalesced. My favourite writer is amongst many, but my favourite is Julian Barnes. And there at my right elbow was Julian Barnes.
Fussing over a pot of tea.
Fussing over a pot of tea, just as you would expect
Julian
Barnes to do.
People wondering, who is Julian Barnes and why might that be important?
He won the Miles Booker, which is neither here nor there. He, in fact, calls the Miles Booker, Booker Man.
The Booker Prize, Man Prize, yeah.
As posh bingo, which is one of the reasons I love him. He has a great turn of phrase. He is a great pricker of English pomposity. He doesn't write about weather or dreams, two of his rules, and he writes as though his parents are dead. That's his third rule. He's very playful. He's also courageous and direct.
What's he written that people will be familiar with?
Sense of an Ending was the book that won the Booker. But the best novel of his, if you really want a head spin, is one of his early books called Flaubert's Parrot. And it's a book that almost embraces about four genres. It's a wonderful work. But he has written 22 novels, I think. And they are many and varied and a wonderful writer.
I'll give you my equivalent then, John Ralston Saul,
okay.
Who is a Canadian author who has been a guest on this program to my extreme delight. And he wrote a book called Voltaire's Bastards and other books about, being curious and inquisitive. And he is a remarkable mind and a remarkable package. He was in Australia and we managed to persuade him to come in some years ago on the Conversation Hour.
Did you get a bit squee, as they say? A little bit fanboy?
I was pretty excited, yeah. Yeah, because, I love what he writes and he changes the way you think. And not just about specific issues, it actually changes the whole way you think. He was the first person, this is where I first learned about him, years ago. Remember the Exxon Valdez, which was an oil tanker that ran aground on rocks in Prince Edward Sound, I
Alaska,
think it was,
ruined
and leaked oil all over a vast area of beautiful, pristine beauty and ruined it forever and led to a massive cleanup of one of the biggest oil spills the world's ever seen. And he explained how that was actually regarded by the economy as a positive because it generated an extra, 0.5% or something of GDP. For Canada because of the cost of cleaning up the spill. So an environmental catastrophe is regarded as an economic good. And he said this is what's wrong with economics. It can't measure anything by way of quality, only in way of quantity. So something as appalling as the Exxon Valdez in economic terms is a positive. Well, that's crazy. We've got to change the way we measure this stuff.
Isn't economics called the dismal science?
Yeah, yeah, but it was brilliant.
Doesn't that highlight
it? I just remember reading that and learning about it and thinking, wow, thank you, thank you, thank you. That changes the way I think about things forever.
Great writers, great speakers, they make you change your mind.
Yeah.
That's very true. But I'm keen about this. I mean, I know we've got guests to come, so we won't tally long, but I'm keen about this idea. You meet your idol, how do you behave? And this is that was the dilemma I was in with Julian.
Did you giggle?
No, I didn't know. I didn't actually interrupt him. I was actually grown up about it.
You didn't say hello?
I didn't then, but after a couple of gin and tonics later when I saw him, I did go up and just say thank you.
And?
And I said, you've always been Barnsley to me.
How did it go?
He doesn't realise the import of that statement because Barnsley for most Australians, that means cold
someone
chisel.
Else, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we all have a place for, you know, that Barnsley, but he's always been my Barnsley. And he took that on face value, I'm sure, and said, thank you very much. Keep reading, he said, and moved on.
Yeah.
Because he would have those, you know, little squee moments from many of his readers, I'd presume. Not that they would lose any value.
No, but to acknowledge someone without intruding.
Without intruding.
Is a nice, finely, it's a tightrope.
Yes.
But to just to say, look, love your work. Thank you very much. Enjoy Sydney if you're at the Sydney Writers Festival. I hope Australia's, you know, been kind to you. That's a good thing to do.
And not to tarry. That's the thing. I think I meant to say tarry before. The idea of, because, I mean, I occasionally get sort of crossword fans who want to go through the dictionary with me. But then I get those people who say, I hate you or I love you. Thank you for your work or not, and move on.
Yeah.
So it's that idea of discretion, but particularly when you meet someone that is, you know, the kind of the mule's eyebrow, someone you really want to linger with, but you know that is not wise.
No, yeah, well, I've had the situation here on this very program, actually, where I've, in fact, felt compelled to say to people, look, I hope you're not this evening sitting in a hotel room eating a, you know, room service ghastly meal, and I hope you have a better experience of Melbourne than that. And occasionally I've even said to people, look, if you want a home-cooked meal and come for, you know, walk the dog down the park, you're very welcome to join us this evening. And occasionally they've said yes, and that's been wonderful.
Yeah, it is wonderful.
Yep.
Up to them.
Yep. David Astle, my co-host, having met his fan, being number idol. One fan, meeting his idol, David Astle is going to meet Pamela Rabe, and I'm sure she's right up there on a pedestal
she's
as
gorgeous.
Well. She's a fabulous actor. You've seen her on television in lots of different things and in theatre if you've been lucky enough to be there as well. She's in the Malthouse Theatre's production of The Glass Menagerie. She's our first guest. Nick Earls has rediscovered the joy of the novella. He's a best-selling author with incredible credits around the world already under his belt. So why novellas, we'll ask him when he joins us.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Performer Pamela Rabe, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
My pleasure. Wonderful, happy Friday.
Wonderful to have you here and for you to drag some extra energy.
into the mix?
Well, it's hard for you because you're on stage, you're performing, you're pouring it out there as a performer on stage, and then you've got to kind of come and talk to people about the show as well.
It's nice to get at it once in a while, yeah.
And in fact, doing two shows yesterday.
Yes, we did. We had a school's performance at an ungodly hour in the morning. and it's actually, that's fabulous, because talk about energy. They bring a very present energy to the conversation. And
do
then
they
we
put
had
their phones down for long enough?
They did. They certainly did. They get so and get wrapped in it. I love that Tennessee Williams can have that effect.
Tell me, Pamela, did they have a Q&A after the performance?
Yep.
What was the question that struck you?
They were all really intelligent questions. Yep. I'm not sure they were on the kind of exam cheat sheet or not, but no, they were great. They were really engaged. And because this is a particular, it's been a very successful production, but it's a particular kind of take on it where Eamon Flack, the director, and Luke Mullins, the lead actor who plays the autobiographical Tennessee Williams character in it, Tom, who's the narrator of the piece, because they've decided to take they're treating it as a queer text. So it's very, very much about the notion of being of difference and how to protect and preserve fragility in a brutal world, and that obviously speaks very directly to young people.
And your character?
I play Amanda Wingfield, who's Tom's mother. Mm-hmm. Rose Riley plays Laura, his somewhat disabled sister. Harry Greenwood plays the gentleman caller, Jim.
And you're the Southern Belle. You're the
Well, she's not so much a Southern Belle anymore, but she's certainly nourishing herself on the memories.
Yeah, of grandeur.
Of grandeur, and some of which might be true and some of which might not be.
Now, I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to see this production.
You've got to get in quick because it finishes in a second.
It finishes in a second and it's selling very well.
Yeah.
So if anyone does want to see it, they better hurry. That's absolutely true. But do you do a drawl, do you, Pamela?
I do a little bit of one, yeah.
Yeah?
And I'd certainly crank it on into overdrive. I'd turn it up to 11 when the gentleman caller arrives.
Put on your best south in the mouth.
Yeah. And that's a bit of fun?
Oh, it's fabulous. It's a wonderful, it's a great gift to be allowed to bring those words alive.
But in that particular way too.
It is. It's just, I mean, it's a huge gamut inhabiting that story. 8 times a week, you know, the range of emotions. I mean, they're desperate people, you know, living in a desperate world, and he gives you so much to kind of chew on.
It's been described as, in fact, by Tennessee Williams himself, as a memory play.
Mm.
How do you understand that as a genre or as a label? What does that entail, a memory play?
Because this was his first great success, and as often happens with writers, the first opus, the first effort is got something very raw about their own story kind of encapsulated in it. And this one is very autobiographical. He wrote it, he chipped away at different versions of it until he finally arrived at a piece of performance writing. But he wrote it, and it was first presented in 43-44, but he set it in 1938. It's very much modelled on his own mother, his own sister. And I think as an act of, I don't know, exorcism or remorse, thank you, goodbye. I mean, the final word of the play is goodbye.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, yes. I think you know it because Tom, the narrator, starts and informs the audience what they're going to be sitting down to see and what it's about, and he describes it in those words as it is a play of memory. Is that I think it's an excuse to get away with being selective and for it to, having quite a bit of editorial comment. It also kind of untethers it from just straight naturalism. You know that even though we inhabit very, very real scenarios within the action of the play, it's also through Tom's eyes, and that kind of releases me as a performer as well to know that he had certain attitudes towards his own mother or Amanda Wingfield, Tom, his mother and his fictional mother, and it means that you know, I can have fun being both the monster, the gargoyle, and also the fiercely loving matriarch of that memory world.
Are they flip sides of the same thing?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's also important, something that I read in an interview with you about loving Amanda. Is that important for every character you inhabit, to love that character?
Absolutely. I mean, if you didn't, why would you do it?
But even something, I mean, thinking of now Governor Ferguson, you know, sort of...
Absolutely adore her.
You do, you?
Yes.
Is that sort of helping you to sort of realise every sort of unmet frustration inside you?
Now we need to explain this because there's a missing piece in your jigsaw puzzle there.
I'm sorry, I just threw that in.
Yeah, you went whoosh on a big...
I did, because I can't... I mean, I suppose these are both very powerful women. They're matriarchs of a kind. Governor Ferguson, who runs the Wentworth prison.
In
the television...
The
leather gloves and
the television show revival of the old Prisoner franchise,
totally.
Starring Pamela Rae,
the freak, menacing, imposing, a martinet, and then you've got Amanda, who is this all-powerful presence in the household. Both characters very strong and prepossessing, but that idea of loving your character, I found that really interesting. I mean, I'd imagine there'd be some characters you may be a little more difficult to love.
I think you have to kind of explain what you mean by loving something. It doesn't mean you can condone necessarily their actions or what they do. It's just that you don't judge them. And that in order to really get inside something and try to make it both credible and entertaining for an audience, you need to immerse yourself in it. And if you're sitting back and judging or hating getting down and dirty and mucky with that character's emotions, you're going to be... you're going to have a lot of trouble doing that. And I would like, I mean, I've been very lucky in my career, but I feel that's one of the most important things, that when somebody approaches you with something, that you've got to have a little twinge, a little tickle inside that goes, ooh, I want to go there. Oh, that's interesting. I'd love to do that.
I see. No,
but does it also mean that occasionally you're asked, the character is, things are written for the character that might just extend beyond where you want to go? It might be, hang on, that's not where I saw the governor going.
Well, there's a certain amount of dialogue you can have, you know, to discuss about it. But with the writers, with the producers. But really, in the end, it's my job to make it work.
Yeah.
So that conversation usually is around, how do we make this work? How do we... And so that I can lose some sort of cool self-conscious third eye that's going, oh, I don't buy this, and really kind of dive in deep. And sometimes it's a big challenge. It certainly threw a few curveballs at me for this current season, which is on.
Yeah, because the more you inhabit a character and the more you embody a character, the more you want to feel that it's not just the writer's vision of where that character goes, but it's also the actor's vision of where that character goes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've met Tennessee Williams.
I did.
You're the only one in the studio who's met Tennessee Williams. How did he strike you? on the left temple?
That's right. on the left cheek.
That is not Amanda. That is not Amanda.
How did you meet Tennessee Williams?
He was extraordinary. That's kind of a long story, and I won't sort of bore you with it. But
I won't be bored, I assure you, Carol.
I was trained at an acting school in Canada on the West Coast in Vancouver, which was a very special school that doesn't exist anymore. And it was attached to a professional theatre company. And part of the process of our training, it was very intensive training, was that in the second year, it was a two-year course, we would be apprenticed into professional shows with the company and then go back into the classroom and debrief and discuss things. And the first thing that we were thrust into was a remount of Tennessee Williams' Red Devil Battery Sign. He'd been invited by the local university in Vancouver, the University of British Columbia, to come and be an artist in residence. And he agreed to attend only on the condition that the main professional theatre company put on a revival of his play that he had not been very happy with a previous production of. And
so what year are we talking about?
They were talking about 1980, okay. Very near his death.
It is.
And it was an extraordinarily happy experience. Well, it was a very exciting experience for me, but it was also professionally a very exciting experience, I think, for Tennessee. And so successful that he came back the next year that, funnily enough, Roger Hodgman, who is now my husband, who was the artistic director of the company at that time, and he and Tennessee got on like a house on fire. I mean, Tennessee actually said Roger was the best man with a script that he'd ever worked with, which was kind of high praise coming. But really, you know, they had a really, really good creative partnership. And Roger commissioned him to do an adaptation of a Chekhov play, The Seagull, which Tennessee had said was his favorite play. So he came back the second year and produced with some gnashing of teeth and pulling of typewriter keys, because there were only certain scenes that Tennessee wanted to write in this, which is evidenced by the title of his play, which the adaptation was called The Notebook of Trigorin. He was only interested in certain characters in the Chekhov story. So I worked with him twice, because I was in that as well. By that time, I'd graduated and was one of the two of my year that was picked up by the company.
And that was with Roger as well?
Yep, that was. And it was pretty extraordinary. I mean, he was a character
and David,
a half.
I shook her hand, and she's shaken.
You play 6 degrees, aren't
Tennessee
you? 2 degrees.
Hand. 2 degrees.
And imagine whose hand Tennessee Williams.
Oh, that's right.
Don't even go there.
You'd even get Nelson Mandela in there somewhere.
Yeah, you sure would. I mean, he was an amazing man. He was people. It was so interesting to meet somebody who, you know, at that point, he was so frustrated, I think, as an artist, because his great works had been so early in his career, and people seemed to want him only to recreate things that he'd, you know, produced as a 30-year-old man. And he was wanting to, as is evidenced, actually, in Glass Menagerie, which is his notes that preface the published script of that, go in great and beautiful lyrical detail about his dreams for what he called a plastic theatre. you know, that all of his work seemed to be hijacked by the method actors and the naturalism movement of American popular culture of the last half of the 20th century. And yet he had great dreams of kind of a quite highly abstracted, theatrical, expressionistic form for his work. And he wanted to keep pushing that envelope all through his career. And people just wouldn't let him. So he was a frustrated fellow, incredibly generous. I've been thinking about him a lot playing Amanda because there's a lot of him in her. He was incredibly gracious to me.
What incredibly a wonderful gracious, story.
What an amazing circle you've drawn
for us to be able to
share. Professional career.
It's just wonderful. Yeah. And to slip my hand into his 8 times a week now is, and to bring him alive so long after his passing for, you know, young, as yesterday morning, young 16, 17-year-olds.
And there's probably a little bit of Tennessee Williams in Wentworth too.
You always take it too far, don't you?
I think I just got the governor's look then. Pamela Ray, The Glass Menagerie, brings Pamela back to the Malthouse Theatre, sharing a bit of Tennessee Williams with us. Nick Earls wants us to rediscover the beauty of the old-fashioned novella, a slim, small volume that gives you the chance as a writer to play around with an idea that maybe wouldn't last for a whole novel but can easily make for a novella. Nick's written 5 of them. They have place names as their titles: Gotham, Venice, Vancouver. Juno. Another Canadian reference. And NoHo. Nick, good morning to you.
Good morning,
welcome
John.
Back to the conversation.
Thank you.
Why,
lovely to be here.
Why novellas are somewhat arcane literary form?
I think this might just be their century. That's what I'm hoping. The 20th century wasn't the best for the novella. I'm hoping the 21st is going to be its natural home, and I want to be part of that. I mean, I think the first and possibly most important reason was that a few years ago, after I wrote my last novel, the ideas that I felt most compelled to write really felt they should be novella-sized. I thought, these are all heading to about 20,000 words, and I want to get them right. I don't want to fake them up into a novel. I want them to be what they need to be, and even if it's an unfashionable choice in the industry. And then I thought, does it need to be unfashionable?
Because I'll make it fashionable.
I'll try to do my bit. Stephen King tried to do his bit 15 years ago with Riding the Bullet. The first commercial ebook was a novella. Hundreds of thousands of people downloaded it in a matter of days. And I started thinking, ebooks, audiobooks, they actually really fit the novella form, and we can do very nice compact little paper books.
Short attention span,
and
the Twitter
limited
age.
Time. Exactly. I worked out
One word titles.
I'm making it easy. And if you look at the covers, it even plays to the kind of adult colouring book thing. So so that's just coincidence. But you know, I worked out when Gangnam Style racked up its billionth view on YouTube, if it had been watched by one person each time all the way to the end, that was 50 million hours of human activity on one video.
How many
on
hours
one
did it take you to work that out?
It took me. Fortunately, the same device that I'd watched it on allowed me to work it out in a matter of seconds. And I worked out that if, just supposing, and there's no science in this, I know, let me just say that now, just supposing a fifth of that time had been spent on reading, it's the equivalent of about a million novels worth of reading that didn't happen because of one video on YouTube.
But it wasn't. It wasn't spent on reading.
No, it wasn't spent on reading.
But you think novellas mean people might be more inclined to pick up a book than something large and heavy?
I honestly think they might. And we are in an era when quite a few big writers are putting out fat books. I read Jonathan Franzen's Purity, 563 pages. And
all the way to the end?
All the way to the end.
A Little Life, it's 700 pages, bestseller.
And there are quite a few of those around, but I have many friends and acquaintances, and now that I've started publishing these novellas, I've heard from a lot of people I don't know who have said that they are shying away from big books or saving big books for holidays but want to read in the meantime and don't like kind of losing the thread because they're doing so many other things so that they lose track of the novel. And this is the novella size gives you a reading experience that lasts for an evening but takes you deep. It's more than a short story.
Oh, you're going to do an illustrated book next, Japanese style, aren't you? You'll do one. Or the French, what are those French illustrated comic books called? The ones where the story is done.
Not the manga, the Japanese ones.
No, those are erotic fiction. No, these are the French just, you know, like not Les quite comic. Tin, not Les quite comic. Tintin no. and Asterix, but they'll be an illustrated book. There's your next challenge.
Okay, thanks. I'll be here in a couple of years talking about that.
Was it the idea that gave birth to the form, or were you excited about doing something in a shorter form?
For me, it was the idea first, and I'd had a number of ideas, small ideas that might have, if I'd isolated them, made a short story. But there were times when I realized, say, in the case of the first one, Gotham, I had the idea of sending an Australian journalist to New York to interview a rapper, and I was interested in writing about rappers. I couldn't get in. That's not me. So I thought, maybe it's more interesting if we don't get into the rapper headspace, and I have someone there interviewing the rapper. But then I thought, what else is the interviewer doing there? What else is at stake for the interviewer? And I'd been to New York not long before. I'd written a travel article on New York with an under five. I'd been there with my son, who was nearly four, and I looked at a photo of him coming down a slide in Central Park with his arms stuck out like a superhero in flight, because New York for him was superhero central, because he was very much into superheroes at the time. And I thought, I'm going to have something like that in there. And I thought, why is my character's son or daughter coming down the slide with her arms stuck out like a superhero? And then something occurred to me, and I thought, that's it, that's his story. So I've got the rapper story, I've got the journalist story, and I really want to bring them together and allow each one to kind of cast light on the other and make it a kind of focused, intense reading experience, but I don't want to make it longer than it needs to be. And I knew it wasn't a short story, and I knew it wasn't a novel unless I threw a lot more at it, and I didn't want to do that.
Nick, have you always had this this compass or this capacity to judge an idea's length when you conceive it?
I'm much better at that now than I think I was 25 years ago when I started. So having written 13 or 14 novels and a few dozen short stories and seven or eight novella-sized pieces, I think I've got more of a sense of, I think experience has taught me more about that.
It's also, it's interesting that novella, the word, has only been around for about a century.
In English, yes.
Yeah. The novella has been a well-established form. A lot of the Gothic novels were novellas. I think of something like Prometheus, which is the Frankenstein myth. Very, very short book.
The word novel in English comes from the word novella.
Is that right?
Yes. The other way around.
It's not the exactly. It sounds like the novella is the sort of diminutive of novel, but that's
absolutely
not the case.
And so I can think of some very long books that should have been short books.
and I've written at least one book that a critic said that about. So when I wrote World of Chickens, I actually wrote a novella, but I found an extra 300 pages of material. And I can't say she was wrong either. She did say there was a great 100-page story in there just trying to get out.
Trying to hatch its way out.
Yeah.
Text messages reminding me, a graphic novel is what I was looking for.
I see.
For
yes.
Graphic novels, and manga apparently is not always erotic.
There you go,
says Dinny. Interesting. So if you're playing around with the length, you're still though packing a lot in. It's a kind of it's a trademark Nick Earls technique to write a page turner and never let us get to the point where we can put it down.
That's very much what I wanted to do. I wanted the reader to be in the moment with the character, and I wanted the moment to deliver something to draw you on. And that's why I didn't want to add 60,000 words to it. I wanted to keep that focus. And each of them takes place over a short period of time. Each of them has its own narrator. And in each case, the narrator is typically taken from his comfort zone and placed somewhere else where he has the experience I want him to have.
Gotham, New York, Manhattan, Venice.
That one is actually set in Brisbane, but the central character has lost his job with the collapse of the mining boom and is living under his sister's house. She's an artist who is aspiring to be Australia's next representative at the Venice Biennale, and it's him trying to find his place while she is certainly finding
hers.
There's
a reference to the flooding of the Brisbane River. maybe that's going to go there.
Vancouver.
Yes, which is actually set in Vancouver. Yes, at Vancouver Writers Festival in 2001.
Pamela's hometown, almost.
One of them, yes.
Juneau in Alaska.
In Alaska, yes. So I did actually go there for that.
And NoHo.
NoHo as in the North Hollywood version of it, not the North of Houston version of it. So,
not a
second Manhattan one, a Los Angeles one.
North of Houston is a district, and NoHo is the opposite of SoHo for Manhattan.
Yes.
So this is Northern Hollywood.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
They're underpinned by a theme, which I suppose you've just touched on, that idea of a character out of their comfort, out of their habitat. First-person narrative. The other idea, I suppose, that I'm seeing in the... I'm reading all about Jeff Foster at the moment in Gotham, in your first novella. There's that idea that you can't escape yourself either. Is that something that recurs through the novellas without giving too much away? That you kind of... You always wake up with yourself, but you don't necessarily wake up to yourself.
Yes, each one of them has some personal business to do. There's some reason to reflect, and I wanted to deliver that in an interesting way, and I thought I've got the freedom to do that wherever I need to put them to do that, and I wanted to look at the things we value and the messages we get about things we should value, and the things that are close to home that might actually be more worth valuing than some of them. So those sort of threads were there, and there are also small connections between them, but they also work to be read independently as well.
So they're not intertwined in the sense that you've got to read one, then two, then three, then four, then
That's
five.
That's right. That you don't have to.
So Pamela's got Venice and I've got Gotham. Can we do a book swap later?
That would be ideal.
Neither of us is disadvantaged.
Neither of you is disadvantaged.
I've got to ask you, Pamela, what do you read when you're doing a show? It's intense as Tennessee Williams. Do you actually get a chance to read? How do you unwind, in terms of what you see, read, hear?
I find it very hard to read fiction when I'm working. Mm-hmm. I suppose that part of your brain and your soul is occupied. And then I do I save the holiday books. So I've got the big pile of the holiday books, but mostly it's nonfiction that I'm reading in journalism.
What?
Oh, everything from, Bill Bryson. I've got a whole pile of things sitting on the side, and new biography of Orson Welles, things like that. Just, kind of stuff that you can, at 1 o'clock in the morning,
wind down with
as you fall asleep.
See, this is another good reason to do novellas.
Yeah.
If that falls on your head, you'll hardly even notice.
You
might wake up, but you will not sustain
like
an injury.
Fairy's Kiss.
This is not a hardback biography, nor is it Franzen's Purity, which, you wake up with a black eye if you got that.
Least,
I love his essays, though.
And they're very gentle on the face if you're only holding one at a time.
Yeah.
Is there a box set, Nick? I've got to ask. I'm very excited about this idea of these five beautiful little books that have this design connect. They have a thematic connect. There's got to be a box. Tell me there's a box, Nick.
Who's to say what we might do down the track?
Why did you stop at five?
For the moment, I just needed to lie down. I had these five ideas and I thought I can bring them all together, and I like the way, while you can read them out of order, the last one is... works for me as the last one because it delivers some things that relate to the others. And I thought that's a great spot to finish it in. And I think they do fit very nicely together.
Yes.
So, I'd encourage people to make their own tiny boxes and these five books will find a home in them.
Now, we should clarify these. You've written for children and you write for teenagers and you write for adults. So which category does this best sit into?
These are for adults, if there are people in the later years of high school who are reading adult material, that's fine. But that's it. That's an important point because I've had some people. My son is 6.5, and I had parents of other kids in the class go, great, we'll have to go and don't get them for Patrick's schoolmates because they're not for 6.5-year-olds just because they're small.
Yeah. Right there, very clever.
But I wonder if we're playing around with formats and ideas, could you write the same story rewritten for younger readers? The same story, but recast?
I think in the case of quite a few of these, yes, I could. I think it would be possible to do that. There are young characters in most of them that they might connect with. And in fact, the last one has an 11-year-old narrator. And what I had to manage there was that balance of I wanted to... He's in Los Angeles because his sister is trying to make it as an actor in the film industry there. And there is that child actor thing that goes on, and I've seen all the documentaries about that, and it's a really interesting thing. So I wanted to have him watching her go through that, and I wanted it to be his perspective, because if it had been an adult perspective, there would have been far too much tendency to judge.
So that would a bit be like, Pamela, doing the same play as you've done before, but playing a different role. Have you ever done that? Ever been cast to play a different role in a play where you've been
I've
in it before?
I've done that a few times. Usually
that would be a bit weird, wouldn't it?
And stuff. No, it's great. It's just different. You fall in love with a different character and sit in, as actors often do too. They tend to kind of see the play through their character's eyes and fight for that character's argument, you know. But
so, and how
like
does
day
it,
for night, yes, it's
how good. Does it feel for you watching someone develop their version of a character that you have played before? And I mean, you're working through various stages of that with them. And how does it feel for them knowing you've done it before?
Probably the latter question is the one that's most difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've been in a room with people who've played roles that I'm now tackling, and that can be a little bit daunting. But finally, it becomes what, you know, it becomes what it is, and you forget about all that. It falls away. That's the stuff that you kind of, that burdens you at the beginning. But once you get into it, you
I can see Nick's going to write a book about an aging actor with the early stages of dementia who comes out in the middle of the play and starts playing the wrong role.
Yes.
That sounds like my kind of territory.
I've just finished reading
Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Station 12, which is
Let me play Thisbe too.
Sorry. No, it's Station 12, which starts off with an elderly King Lear who actually has a form of dementia during his performance. It's set in Toronto, just before the, you know, this race-erasing virus strikes the city. It's actually a sort of subtopian, dystopian novel, but it's based on starts off with a prominent actor who has dementia.
So that's those are two very different ideas put together.
They
for
are.
That. I wasn't expecting. When you were talking about the actor, I thought this is a really interesting character piece, and then suddenly a race erasing virus strikes the city.
I wish I could remember the author's name offhand. I can't. She's a Canadian writer, and it's it was a fine book, she plays the idea of the Armageddon as though it has already happened. It happens in a moment,
right,
and then we follow the action 20 years later, and Shakespeareans are those who help civilise the population that is left. It follows a travelling troupe of Shakespeareans. They're the principal characters in the novel.
And do they mercilessly muck around with and
not at all
subvert the plays in their off time? Because I've always wanted to see a film or a play which shows you what goes on when they're not on stage, when you mercilessly deconstruct the play. And
that was, I have to
mock
say, it was an idea that I've had for about 15 years, well before Big Brother and stuff. I wanted to have a dressing room cam.
Yeah.
Because I always thought that was, there was so much drama in it. Nudity, gossip, product endorsement.
Tears.
That's right. Discussion of, you know, popular contemporary issues. Everything goes on in dressing rooms. It's fabulous.
If you want to talk about actors and the truth, you should see what goes on backstage.
Russell Howcroft should be listening to this conversation.
It's like the gags we have about what goes on in the radio station. Some of our best work happens before we come into the studio. But I wouldn't possibly lift the lid on that. Now, congratulations, Nick.
Thank you, John.
Congratulations on rediscovering the novella. And now watch out, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, it's Nick Earls who reintroduced the novella. And when all these other copycats come along, just go, oh, Nick was first to do that. Pamela Rabe on stage at the Malt House for the Glass Menagerie. And thank you so much for giving us particularly the Tennessee William memories this morning. Pamela Rabe, Nick Earls are our guests. David Astle, the Cruciverbalist, has been my co-host. Thank you all so much for coming to play on The Conversation Hour today.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.